Welcome back to episode 2 of the Let It Fly podcast with Ravi Lula, that's me, and Taylor Stormberg, the voice of the, well, one of the voices of the Creighton Blue Jays men's basketball team. I don't want to take too much shine off our guy John Bishop there.
John would not be okay with that.
You got to watch out for Johnny the Bish. That's his street name, Johnny the Bish.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, he'll come out. John Bishop, nicest guy in the world. Johnny the Bish, he'll break your kneecaps.
Well, I was a little worried about him after the Rams tried to give that game away to the Bucks, because he's a big Rams guy, so he probably would have come after a few kneecaps.
You got to be more worried about him this week. He's playing the 49ers, and they're not faring well against the Niners lately.
No, they are not. 0-2 this season.
Yeah, they've lost, I think, 6 in a row to the 49ers. They haven't beat them in like 3 years.
Ooh, and that's your team, kind of.
We don't speak on these weeks. We try and keep our distance, you know. We were actually, Taylor and I were talking before the podcast started here, and you know, we are sort of getting to know each other as well as you guys are getting to know us, and we're like, well, we should maybe record some of these things so people actually know who we are when they listen to us. And so my first question was, because, you know, I've seen you around the radio station a little bit, and I've seen you roll up in a car that's way too nice to be doing radio full time. So I was like, what do you do exactly, Taylor?
Ravi, good question. That car was a recent purchase. I will not disclose how it came about. No, I'm just kidding. No, I work on a professional level, I run a sales team here in Omaha for a company called the Alliance Group. We do back-end HR services for small, medium-sized businesses across the Midwest. So I pretty much spend the majority of my day talking to business owners of all different types of industries, get to know them, get to know their business, their pain points, and kind of see how we might be able to fit in on some of that back-end employee work. So I've been doing that for about the last about a little bit more than 2 years.
Well, there you go. I know a lot of, every time I talk to an ex-athlete there, or as somebody who's about to leave their athletic field, a lot of them are like, I just don't want to end up selling insurance. So you didn't end up doing that. So I think that's a win. Is that like the nightmare of everybody who ever plays a sport in college? You're like, I just don't want to sell insurance.
Just don't make me sell insurance and just make sure I'm not a financial advisor. Those are the two.
Always.
Yeah, so I, you know, part of what we do is insurance, but I don't actually have to sell that. So it's a little bit different, which I'm okay with. The lines are, they're a little blurry, but there's still a definitive mark, like, nope, you're not an insurance sales guy. So
it's separate enough that you don't feel like the cliche, right?
True. Very true. Very true. But Ravi, I'm going to flip the question back to you, my friend. What is it that you do between the hours of 8 and 5 every day?
Well, so I actually don't do it between 8 and 5. I have weird hours. I work weird hours. I usually only work 4 days a week, and then I have 3-day weekends, which are terrific. But I do financial investigations. Right now, that means I'm doing mostly government sanctions work for a financial institution. Previously, I've done anti-money laundering, anti-fraud work, stuff like that. So that's basically what I've been doing my entire adult life, is some sort of fraud or financial institution investigations.
Very cool. So is this, you're the guy that cracked the Bernie Madoff case. Is that
not you? Not quite. Those, yeah. Usually what'll happen when you see something like that is, someone like me probably played a part at some point in that investigation. Usually what happens is the financial institutions, we report things up to either government or federal agencies, things like that. We just find them, and then we deal with catching them and everything. We let everybody else deal with the hard part of the, we're just like, hey, that looks weird. Don't do that anymore.
Don't do that. I don't think you're allowed to do that. Yeah.
And then we send it off, and we're like, hey, somebody who has a badge, this looks weird.
Yeah.
So please, that's basically my job.
Please go see what's going on. Okay. Yeah. Very cool. So then, I mean, the obvious next question is, do we have to get the FBI involved with some of this? Is there some forensic accounting that goes on at the government level that you have to get involved? Like,
I have done investigations that I've gotten the FBI involved. I've done investigations. A lot of what I do now is like Homeland Security related, like anti-terrorism financing and stuff like that. Trying to make sure that kind of stuff isn't going on financial platforms. But I've done investigations. Actually, the most interesting one that I ever did was there was a company that was a front for a cocaine dealer. And they were basically stuffing drugs inside of teddy bears and shipping them out all across the country or whatever. We're like, why are these expensive ass teddy bears? Why do they cost so much? This is weird. And we basically figured it out that way. We're like, that's too much for a teddy bear. What's happening here?
The only reasonable human should spend that much for a teddy bear, right?
So the FBI got involved on that one. We've had some like bankruptcy cases and stuff that the FBI will get involved in because it ends up being fraudulent activity. But the cocaine teddy bear is just my favorite one that I've ever done.
I think that'll be a good story to tell someday.
I feel like it should be a like an off color children's movie, Cocaine Teddy Bears.
I think, you know, there's probably a market for that somewhere. I'm not gonna say it's a bad idea.
You know, like those Ted movies with Mark Wahlberg, like I'm like his, if he goes off the rails, he becomes Cocaine Teddy Bear, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect. I think we've already found out what Mark Wahlberg's doing for the next 5 to 10 years.
Listen, if we can get him into on the project, we'll all be rich. We can all quit doing radio.
Very true. It'll just be another version of Entourage.
Listen, I understand that show was terrible, but I loved it. I couldn't help it.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. Everybody has to take a little time to go check out Entourage.
Just appreciate Entourage.
Just appreciate it. That's all we're asking. You don't have to like it. Just respect it.
Well, at some point here, we should probably talk about Creighton basketball, I suppose.
Good. Is that what we're here to do today?
Allegedly. I mean, it's called the Let It Fly podcast. We got a little bird logo. I assume it's Creighton related. We do have a couple games to go over here. Creighton's coming off of, you know, a little mini win streak, two straight wins, 87-64 over St. John's, 60-47 over DePaul. And we're going to get you previewed a little bit for the Creighton Butler game, at Hinkle on Wednesday night. So we'll start there with the games that they've already played this past week. I guess, Taylor, I don't want to get too far into the nitty gritty on anything specific here, but I'll start you off with this general. Trey Alexander has really emerged this week. He won the Big East Freshman of the Week award. And I guess, what have you made of his emergence as kind of this primary ball handler almost out of nowhere?
Yeah, no, I think the story of the last two games has to be Trey Alexander, right? Obviously, Creighton winning both of those games, but him playing a massive role in both of those wins. And I think it's more than just the ball handling, Robbie. I think it's the production that he's bringing off the bench. I mean, when you look across Creighton's games, you're seeing them being drastically outscored from a bench standpoint, mm-hmm. because they don't bring a lot of guys off the bench. And when they do, they're not out there to score. And the majority of those folks are first-year players in the Creighton system. And so to have a guy like Trey Alexander come in and show his development, mm-hmm. I think right at a critical time too, right? I mean, Big East play getting kicked off, Creighton now 4-2. And to see him just continually accelerate his game, I've been wildly impressed with how he's been able to do that, because you mentioned he's able to do it ball handling, but you could see him get to the rack. You could see him play great defense in that DePaul game earlier mm-hmm. this week, right? And he's a capable knockdown 3-point shooter when left open.
Well, I think the thing that's impressed me most is when they've started to ask more of him he's started to answer that bell even more. I mean, I've liked what we've seen from him in the minutes he's gotten all year. Early in the year, he wasn't playing a ton, and then he kind of ramps up into that like 20, 25 minute range as Arthur started to, you know, start to struggle a little bit, although Arthur played great the last couple games as well. But what I was most impressed with was how, and we talked about this, I think, before also, just how calm he is with the basketball, how poised he is. You know, he had Posh Alexander in his face the entire time against St. John's, and that's about as good of an on-ball defender as you're going to come across anywhere in the country, not to mention all the pressure they put on him, or that St. John's puts on you in with the just their schemes and their philosophy. The fact that he was just locked in, calm, poised, and comfortable in the face of, I mean, that was his first extended primary ball handling minutes as a collegiate player against that kind of pressure, and it didn't seem to faze him at all.
No, it didn't. And you can see what Posh, you turn on the TV anytime St. John's is playing, and you can see what Posh Alexander does to
he just veteran. Lights people up. Yeah,
he does. And so Trey, I think being a little bit longer, right, I think that helps him from ball handling perspective. He can use his body to shield off defenders, and he's never going too fast, right? He's always under control. He doesn't have, you know, incredible acceleration. He just is really good and really shifty with how he moves his body and how he takes care of the basketball. I mean, over the last two games, 6 assists, only 2 turnovers, both of those coming in that St. John's game. But again, first time seeing extended minutes as a primary ball handler.
That, and I mean, what he reminds me of is, honestly, he reminds me of kind of that, you know, one of those classic, you know, Villanova 2 guards where gets into the lane, comes to a jump stop, never overextends himself, and allows himself to kind of review the floor and see what everything's happening before committing to something. I think that's where a lot of Ryan Nembhard's turnovers have come, is he thinks something's going to be there and anticipates it being there and doesn't come to that kind of controlled stop. And then when it's not there, he ends up turning the ball over. That's not, I think, some, because Trey Alexander isn't necessarily used to making the same type of plays that Ryan Nembhard does, I think he allows himself a little more time to process. And not to say that what Ryan Nembhard does isn't going to work eventually, or he's going to figure it out eventually, because I think he will. But I think because Trey Alexander is more of a 2 guard, he's more about getting to a certain place and reacting, and that allows him to just stay a little bit more under control. I've just been really impressed with not only the fact that he's been able to take care of the ball, but the rest of his production has increased from that as well. He's just been playing really good basketball in the last few games especially, and it comes at a time when they needed him, because Ryan Nembhard has been struggling.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Robbie. And I think, you know, he single-handedly changed the second half for Creighton against DePaul. Going into halftime, down 9 against the Blue Demons, he came out, they moved to that kind of three-quarter court, full-court press defensively. But what was really interesting to watch was the half-court capabilities of DePaul, because they could not get anything when they switched Trey, when Creighton switched Trey Alexander over guarding the point. They could not get anything in the half court. And that really bothered DePaul, because they were obviously taking up 10, 12, 15 seconds getting into their offense, and then only had that same amount left to get comfortable in the quarter court. But his defensive presence in that second half, I think, single-handedly changed the outcome of that basketball game.
I totally agree. And the defensive side of things is something that I've thought he's done well pretty much all year. I think that's probably what was earning him minutes initially, was his ability to defend a little bit at that guard spot. And it does kind of show you, and you can speak to this a little bit better than I can, just the difference that ideal size can make in these situations, right? Because Ryan Nemhard, he's not tiny. He's what, 6'1"? He's maybe a little lighter than you'd like him to, but he's a true freshman, so that's not a huge deal. But the fact that Trey Alexander, 6'4", maybe a little bit bigger than that, has the length, has that prototypical size you want out of a Big East guard, and just how much easier life seems for him, even though he's not a, you know, you're a prototypical point guard in the sense of didn't really play that position a ton since he was playing in summer ball in high school and really hasn't played that position at all in college. It's not what they recruited him for. But because he does have that ideal size, it seems like it's made a huge difference.
Yeah, no, it is. And you can, there's usually two different types of player, right? From a defending standpoint, right? You've got a great offensive player. So you're either going to combat that with speed or you're going to combat that with length.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely do you get both from a defensive standpoint. And so you saw what happened in that first half against DePaul with Nemhard trying to defend those ball screens, trying to defend that dribble weave action that was happening. And as soon as they got downhill, there was no worry about, hey, can I throw this up to the rim? Do I have a floater? Can I pull up for a jump shot? Because he's 6 foot tall, right? Mm-hmm. Insert Trey Alexander, combat that offense with size. Now he's starting to fight around some ball screens, but when DePaul starts to get downhill, they're worried about him coming from the backside, blocking that or affecting that shot attempt inside of the paint. And so those are really the two differences right there between Ryan Nemhard and Trey Alexander.
Well, and we saw that where he did have a super clean rejection on kind of a mid-range attempt. I don't know if it was going to be a floater or a traditional jump shot against DePaul, but just had a super clean rejection. I imagine that his length was either deterring or impacting some of the other shots that he didn't get a hand on. But what about on the offensive side of the ball? When you're a primary ball handler, you were a point guard, how much does that size help in either being able to see over the defense so you can see what's going on, see where the other defenders are coming from, or just having a little bit more size to keep those defenders at arm's length when you're the primary ball handler?
Yeah, offensively, it makes all the difference, right? It's kind of like a quarterback, right? It's seeing over the offensive line. You could sometimes see some of those small quarterbacks struggle because mm-hmm. they can't necessarily see where that ball is going to be, where the receiver is. And it helps you just see more than one play or one pass ahead, right? So you're seeing the whole floor. You're able to see all five guys and the defense instead of just saying, oh, I got to make this entry pass to the right wing, or, oh, I got to feed the ball into the post. You're able to see the entire floor, which is then opens you up to being able to make some plays that aren't necessarily just, you know, your average typical play from a point guard. And so I think Trey Alexander, especially being a little bit taller, a little bit lengthier, helps him in that regard. And then it also helps him when he gets closer to the rim. I mean, most point guards aren't able to jump stop in the paint and still get a shot off, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're usually crowded in there with some trees, with some 6'10", 6'11", 7 foot guys. And so for him to get in there, jump stop, be strong, be powerful with the basketball and still be able to finish over his, not just his primary defender, but the secondary defender, and or make plays for his teammates when he's down there, that's a huge difference in that 4 to 5 inches that Ryan Nemhard's giving up.
Well, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. Is it's not that necessarily that Ryan Nemhard just isn't fundamentally sound enough to jump stop. It's that at his size, he usually has to get his shots off a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the case when you're a 6'4", 6'5" guy like Trey Alexander, who has that extra size to be able to jump stop, be able to be patient, and then go up and still get a shot off. If Ryan Nemhard jump stops most of the time, yeah, he might get some fouls with guys jumping into him, but he's probably not getting a good shot off most of the time. No. Trey Alexander, we saw it late against DePaul especially, he could jump stop, get in there, get the foul, and finish. And that's just something that when you're at the size of Ryan Nemhard, that's probably not in the realm of possibilities for things you're capable of. And honestly, it just makes me appreciate a guy like Maurice Watson so much more, because mm-hmm. he was even, I mean, what, 2-3 inches shorter than Nemhard, and basically got whatever he wanted on the inside. I mean, you just have to appreciate that level of skill so much more when you realize just how much smaller he is than even undersized point guards.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I firsthand experience got a chance to back up a guy by the name of Austin Chapman. Same thing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he's a guy that's 6 foot, maybe a little bit shorter than that, and he's still able to get his shot off inside the paint, but it's difficult, and you got to come up with some crafty ways. And that's why you see Nemhard coming up with, you know, some of those kind of circus shots underneath the basket as he's going, you know, crossing underneath the rim. He's using the rim as protection, but he doesn't even jump. Or he's trying to get that floater off when he's coming downhill, mm-hmm. going up against the bigs. And so, you know, as a smaller guy, you start to come up with crafty ways to get your shot off. Otherwise, you're not going to be seeing the floor very much.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not one of those people that, and I don't think there are very many of these people that think that Ryan Nemhard's won't learn from his struggles and learn from these things. But having someone be able to step up the way Alexander has while Nemhard has been kind of going through this rough patch has really allowed Creighton to keep themselves in that NCAA tournament conversation. Because if you're going through these struggles with your starting point guard, who's a true freshman and going through some growing pains, and you don't have anybody else there to back it up. I think we talked about this last week with not having Sharif Mitchell, is that's a good way to have your season go from NCAA tournament team to NIT team really quick. And that emergence of Trey Alexander has really provided the opportunity for Creighton to still consider themselves an NCAA tournament team as they get, I mean, we're almost to February now, and they're still right in that mix.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's more than just Trey. I think it's the whole, it's kind of gone across the whole team, Ravi. I mean, their ability to find different ways to win basketball games. You know, I never thought we'd be saying this on a Let It Fly podcast, but I mean, they only made 3 threes in that game against DePaul, but they held DePaul to 15 second half points.
And like half of those were garbage second half points, honestly. I mean, they had 8 points through 16 minutes and 50 seconds, something like that. I think when they shot those 4 free throws on the technical foul, I think they were at 8 points and it was like 3:09 it left in the game. They had given up 8 points through almost 17 minutes of play. And they not only made three, they only shot 4 in the second half.
Yeah,
and so, three or four. Yeah, I don't even know.
Three, if it was four. One of three in the second half.
Yeah, so they only shot 3 in the second half, and so for a Creighton team to not even really have to keep you honest with the threat of a 3-pointer for an entire half is just stunning to me. I mean, I believe at one point they were on a 24-2 run, and it took like 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It took most of the second half, and it was just kind of a remarkable way. You talked about all the different ways they've won games, and I'll use that as an opportunity to talk about the St. John's game from earlier in the week. The two wins against St. John's and DePaul couldn't have looked more different.
No, they really couldn't. Yeah. I mean, so in the first half of that DePaul game, Creighton went 2 of 14 from three. In that St. John's game, they made 14 threes.
And right.
I think they came out a little excited about, hey, we're back at home again for the second time in a row. You know, we got a couple JJ Reddicks on this basketball team, all of a sudden, a couple Kyle Korvers out here on the floor. And that just wasn't the case. The shots weren't falling early. And, you know, you got to give a little bit of credit to interim head coach Al Huss, because he turned that around, right? I mean, he said, hey, boys, let's get this ball inside. Let's keep feeding Kalkbrenner, who ended up with a career-high 6 blocks in that game as well.
Huge another game for Kalkbrenner.
Another focal point of that. But they really pounded the ball inside, and they made a concentrated effort to attack the rim, to attack the paint and get high-quality shots after jump-stopping, after getting DePaul off of its feet. And then, you know, I think the implementation of that press to get some energy and some momentum back in their favor I mean, that really turned the tide in that ball game, because I DePaul was just too comfortable in the first half, eating up clock, doing the dribble weaves, and then getting a late ball screen after the defense was tired and getting a high quality shot. So, you know, give credit to Al Huss and the staff for making that change in the second half. And, you know, we'll get a chance to see Al try to go 2-0 this season tomorrow night.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think is most impressive about this team. And the thing that one of the things that has me most excited about this team as we move into February and March, and then even looking ahead to next year a little bit, is once this team does figure out how to shoot with any level of consistency, the fact that they do have all of this experience winning ugly and winning these gross looking games where, you know, they score, what, they score 23 points in the first half, 24 points in the first half against DePaul, and then they come out and win that game anyway, and by holding DePaul at 15 points in the second half, and just that ability to win in all sorts of different ways. Once this team comes around offensively, which I fully think they're going to, because, you know, we saw the offensive firepower that Arthur Kaluma will bring to the table. We've seen the flashes from Ryan Nemhard earlier in the season. We're seeing the emergence of Trey Alexander now. We still have Mason Miller as a redshirt, who I think is going to be a really good basketball player as well and brings a ton to the table offensively, you know, when we're talking about next year. Mm-hmm. I'm just really excited for the fact that they're going to have a ton of experience to draw on in terms of winning in so many different styles, where a lot of Creighton teams in the past didn't have that in their bag.
No, they did not. I mean, they fully expected to win basketball games based on their ability to make three-point shots. And that was the only thing that they could hang their hat on. And so for this young group of guys to be able to find different ways to win tough basketball games, that's only going to pay dividends for future wins in Big East play, you know, next year and in years to come. And like you said, I'm just excited to see where that growth goes, because we're seeing that inside of each game from these players, mm-hmm. and then in, you know, from game to game. And so, you know, what this team looks like when they put it all together, who knows? Hopefully there's a game where we get to see that, you know, two or three games we get to see that in March. But that's the name of college basketball. You got to be playing your best basketball going into end of February and early March. And so this team is certainly trending in the right direction with, you know, a pretty daunting task of the month of February. that's slowly looming around the corner. Quite frankly, it even starts tomorrow night or Wednesday night at Butler at Hinkle Fieldhouse, where we have not played. We have not played good basketball here, Robbie. I try to find a PC way to go about that, but we typically do not play well there.
Yeah, it's a there's not a lot of pretty ways to say it. Creighton has struggled at Hinkle Fieldhouse for sure. That's actually one of the only road venues I've been to in the Big East is Hinkle. I went a few years ago to watch Creighton out there, and it was an ugly performance. It was super ugly that day against Butler. But it does give me a little hope, because again, this Creighton team is a little bit more, a little bit better equipped to win some of those ugly games that than teams in the past. And thankfully, this is not quite as quality of a Butler team as we've seen in recent years. Although, you know, they have, you know, they gave Providence a really a run for their money just on Sunday. They've been playing really well in general against quality basketball teams. It's one of those things where you hope that they don't have their one breakout performance of the year against Creighton on Wednesday night, but it does seem like that does come up and bite Creighton more often than not at Hinkle.
It typically does, and I don't know what it is. I'm kind of happy that we're not playing that Saturday morning game there. Where
yeah, like that 11 a.m.
Yeah, you've got the fog rolling in and the sun is hitting you in the face as you're trying to shoot. So it will be a night game during the week, which is definitely in our favor. But there's something about those rims. There's something about that place that, you know, we're just going to have to find a way, and it'll probably be a different way of winning a road basketball game in the Big East Conference.
So I want to go back to you were talking about Coach Huss and some of the adjustments he made against DePaul in the second half, especially. What in your experience, and I'm trying to remember, I don't think you had a game where Coach Mack wasn't available and you had an interim coach at all, because it's not a super common situation, even though it has happened twice in the last 2 years here for Creighton. But in your experience, what is going to be the biggest, or between DePaul and then Butler here, what is the biggest thing that they'll miss from Coach Mack when he's not out there that Al Huss is going to have to step up and do?
Yeah, it was pretty eye-opening to hear the players and Al after the game both talk about the same thing, and that was Coach Mack's poise and just his ability to stay even keel no matter, you know, if Creighton is up 20 or they're down 20. And he has the same mannerisms and he goes about his business and his relationships in the same way. And so that's, I think, what they're going to miss outside of, you know, that's their guy, right? That's their leader. That's who they look to in times of struggle. That's who they're looking to when things are going well and to be excited for them. And so I think Al's, you know, he even said it. He's like, that's you take a little bit of something away from every head coach that you work for and work with. And he's just said, without a doubt, that's probably Coach Mack's biggest pro as a coach, is just his ability to always have that even keel mannerism to make sure that his team stays in balance with where they need to be, no matter what the score, no matter how they're playing, because he knows that he's got a good enough team to be in any ball game.
Well, and you know, we talked about how this team is learning how to win in different ways. I mean, Coach Mack at this point in his career has seen just about every different type of game, right? There's not very many situations that the basketball gods can throw at him that he won't be ready for, because at this point in his career, you know, he's what, 30 years into being a head coach at this point, almost, that there's really not much left to surprise him. And so I do think it's interesting that you pointed to that portion of the equation as far as what Coach Mack brings to the table as opposed to something on the technical side, because I think a lot of fans and a lot of people that watch not just Creighton but any team don't necessarily appreciate that portion of things and how important that can be for a team. Because I've worked under head coaches where, you know, they tend to get on the refs a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And as a result, the players tend to think that the refs are either out to get them or that they're always getting bad calls or things like that. And it's a direct reflection of the head coach, right? If they argue with every call, the players think every call is wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're a guy like under a coach like Coach Mack, where he's constantly calm, he's constantly poised, he's constantly, you know, acting like everything's under control, even if in the back of his mind, he's like, what are we going to do here? His the face that he presents to his team is always one of poise and confidence. And I just don't think people realize how much of that rubs off on players.
Yeah, it does. And you can see that across the board, because you got all different types of personalities, right? When you're coaching a basketball team,
yeah,
you're just coaching one guy, right? You've got 13 to 15 deep, and you're trying to continue to develop a relationship, a coaching mentorship, and get them to be at their best when they need to. And so not only is he demanding, but he also has that kind of that grace, if you will, to be willing to, you know, forgive some of the mistakes that young players are going to make, and know that that's part of the learning and development process of the majority of the guys on this team. And so when you go into the locker room and he's not, you know, dropping F-bombs and making you feel like you're, you know, he's not belittling you and making you feel like you're less of a person, like that, one, that's just being a good person, right? But two, that means, hey, that's a guy that I want to go out and give everything that I have for that second 20 minutes to make sure that we come out victorious.
So in your experience, and specifically with Coach Mack, obviously he's got this really unique situation where he's got an entirely new basketball team from last year. A lot of them are freshmen or playing Division I basketball for the very first time. How do you think he's handling the, okay, holding guys accountable for making mistakes, you know, whether that's pulling them aside, benching them for a little bit, versus allowing them to grow and learn from those mistakes? Because that's a really fine line to walk, especially when you have a team that, like I mentioned earlier, is still very much an NCAA consideration. But you've got a guy like, you know, I don't want to pick on Ryan Nemhard, but you have a guy like Ryan Nemhard who's been struggling lately. He only went 4-14 in that DePaul game, even though he did clean up those turnovers quite a bit, which was very good. Or a guy like Arthur Kaluma, where he went through a stretch where he wasn't playing particularly good basketball, and then he goes off for 20 against St. John's. I guess, how do you find that, or how has Coach Mack found, in your experience, that balance between holding guys accountable and letting them play through their struggles and learn from it?
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest piece is the trust factor, Robbie, right? You've got to be able to, not only does the players have to trust that the coaching staff's going to put them in good positions, but the coach has got to trust the players can follow and execute that game plan. And so, you know, I think the biggest example of this has been the turnover problem that Creighton has had so far this season. And, you know, while you could sit there and harp on that night in and night out, you know, he says, you know, this isn't what we see in practice. You know, this is just happening in games. And so we just, as a coaching staff, he puts it on himself to continue to put those guys in better spots and not make a bigger deal out of something than it is. Right? I mean, if you keep talking about turnovers and, hey, we keep turning the ball over, why do we keep doing this? Why does it happen in this situation? Guess what's going to happen, Robbie? You're probably going to turn the ball over, right? Yeah. And yeah. So especially with that young crew that he's trying to develop, it's not worth it, right? The long-term development of these guys isn't worth getting mad over one bad play because a guy left his feet too early and didn't have an outlet. Or, you know, a guy accidentally stepped on the out-of-bounds line when he's in the corner. You know, that those aren't things that you need to continually harp on, because it's not going to help the long-term progress of some of these young players.
Speaking of which, have we measured the width of the court at the Championship Center lately? Because I have never seen a team step on a sideline so many times. I don't think combined in my entire life as Creighton has this season. I think we need to make sure we got our measurements right out there.
Yeah, I think we do too. I think the rule is just going to be, if you catch it in the corner, you have to shoot it.
Or like, at least, and I know players like to do that, like step back before they take off or whatever. Just no more. You don't get to do that anymore. You're always in that triple threat. No more. We don't get any more step backs on the sideline.
I think if you catch the ball in the corner, Robbie, it's an automatic shot.
Let it fly, right? That's what we do here. That's what we do here.
Exactly. What I'm gonna ask you a question. What do you think about what do you think about this game on Wednesday?
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough because you kind of get little like mini sports PTSD with some of these teams and some of these venues, right? Like, I get it a little bit with Providence. I get it a little bit with St. John's. I get it really bad with Hinkle, right? Where I'm just like, man, we never play well there. And I don't, you know, regardless, I look at this Butler team and I'm like, you know what? This Butler team, not that impressed, right? I look at them, I say, I think we can do some work against this Butler team, but I have it in the back of my head, you know, we never play. I've got the same thing with Georgetown, right? We lose a game to Georgetown we shouldn't lose almost every year. And you know, I'm never particularly impressed with Georgetown, so part of that's probably on me. But this year especially, like, Georgetown's really bad. They're, you know, they're 6-10 overall. Butler's under 500. They're 9-10 overall. But I still think going into there, it's going to be a tough environment. I agree with you. It's better than that weird Saturday noon game or 11 game that Creighton seems to play there every year. But I just look at a team like Butler, and I know that they can play close games against, you know, Providence and almost come out with a win there, but I don't know. I've never been like a big Aaron Thompson guy. That's just not, I've never thought he was necessarily that dynamic. Kind of the same thing with Enzi and Golden. I know they have their moments and that they can, you know, that they can do some damage against teams, but I just look up and down their roster and I'm like, you know, Creighton matches up okay. None of these guys particularly scare me. I think this is a game that Creighton needs to win if they're an NCAA tournament team. And yeah. I think it's probably going to be of the ugly variety because that's kind of what Butler wants to do to you. But if Creighton wants to take themselves seriously as an NCAA tournament team, this is a game they probably need to come away with. And that's not to say that if they lose, there's no way they're making the tournament. I'm not a bracketologist. I'm not making that kind of declaration here. I'm just saying if you're an NCAA tournament team, these are like sub 500 teams in conference on the road. Those are the road games you have to get, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, you got to do two things, right? You got to take care of home court and you got to beat the bottom half of the league when you go on the road. And you do those things and you're ending up in that 4 or 5 seed every single year. And traditionally that's what Creighton has been able to do, except at Hinkle Fieldhouse. And so,
right.
You've got a veteran team in Butler. As you mentioned, you've got Enzi and Golden and Thompson, and then you've got a prolific scorer in Chuck Harris. And so they're going to have to figure out a way to stop him, because that guy can really fill it up. And so I'm always a little nervous going into Hinkle, but Butler is one of those teams that hasn't really put it together. They haven't figured it out. And for whatever reason it is, they're going to have to find a winning streak quickly if they want to even be part of the conversation come March for that Big East tournament, because they are on a fast slide downhill.
Well, and you mentioned Harris, who shot the ball from three really well last year, was right at 40%. He's down below 33% this year and is, 35% from the field this year. So he's really struggling from an efficiency standpoint. But those are the kind of guys that Creighton eats up, right? Those inefficient volume shooters, Creighton feasts on those guys defensively. And so that's why I look at this team, and I'm glad you brought up Harris because I forgot to, but you look at this team and you're like, okay, these are the kind of guys Creighton can do well against. These are the types of players that, you know, there's no hyper-efficient Colin Gillespie's out here, which Creighton, even both times I thought against Villanova, they did a good job on Gillespie. Just everybody else beat him for Villanova the second time. But there's none of these hyper-efficient guys that are going to give Creighton trouble in that sense. And so that's why I keep looking at this matchup. I'm like, you know, I think I like the matchup. I just, if it was anybody besides Butler and Hinkle, I'd feel way better about it, right? But just looking at the team kind of in a vacuum, this isn't a team that particularly scares me. And you mentioned they have a ton of experience, and they do. You know, you've got guys like Hodges, who are transfers from East Tennessee, who's playing in his fifth year of college basketball. Golden's been playing for a long time. Enzi's been playing for a long time. Thompson's been playing seemingly since you were playing. Like, Thompson seems like he's been playing forever.
Yeah, and that's a guy, Aaron Thompson and Bryce Enzi, I feel like they've been in the Big East for the last 7 years, but I also feel like they should both be a little bit better and more productive than they are, right? I mean, when 100%. You look at Aaron Thompson, you're like, wow, this guy's quick, he's got good vision, he's a lefty, he plays incredible defense.
Can't shoot the ball to save his life.
Can't shoot the ball, right? Yeah. And then you got a guy like Enzi, and you're like, he's a physical specimen. Like, he should take over basketball games. And then he's missing bunnies. And so, I LaVall Jordan, he's got to figure this out quickly, because, like I said, they are on the fast train to the bottom of the Big East if they don't start getting some wins, especially at home.
Yeah, and you mentioned Enzi, and he's got that kind of build, like that classic Villanova wing we talked about, right? Kind of that like 6'7", the physicality of a guy that you expect to see playing in the NBA. But you look at his numbers ever since transferring from Milwaukee, his numbers have kind of dropped off in terms of efficiency each year. His shooting has been super erratic. They've got a lot of guys on that roster, Thompson especially. If you give a guy to Creighton that they just don't have to guard from the three-point line, that's a gift. They'll scheme around that all day. And then if you put another guy out there in Enzi who's hyper inconsistent, and then you put a guy out there in Harris who – you probably treat him with a little more respect because of what he did on some good volume last year, but this year he's not shooting the ball well. If he comes out not shooting well again, you're talking about multiple guys that you don't have to treat as shooters for Creighton. That's, you're kind of gift wrapping a defensive scouting report there for him in a way that Creighton typically handles really, really well. So that's, like I said, I look at this team on paper and I'm like, yeah, this is a team that Creighton should match up great against. But it's Butler and Hinkle House, so who knows?
Yeah. Well, and you're looking at a team that's struggling offensively. I mean, I'm looking at their last four games right now, 42 points at Villanova, 59 points at Connecticut, 56 versus Connecticut at Hinkle. And then on Sunday against Providence, only 62 points. So, you know, if you're taking a great top three defensive team, field goal team in Creighton and the Big East against a very poor Butler team that struggles to score, recipe says, yep, this is a W, but we both know it's not that easy.
Yeah, and I'm just looking back at their schedule. They haven't scored more than 70 points in a win against a Division I team since mid-November. I think Troy is the last, and they scored right at 70. They scored like 84 against Chaminade, but that's not a Division I team. When they're winning games, and most of their games in general are all under 70 points. They did score 72, but that was a 15-point loss to Xavier, so you kind of chalk that up to just, you know, Xavier letting it go at the end a little bit. This is a team, like you said, that's struggled a ton offensively. Creighton's been a really good defensive team. And even aside from, like I said, the major statistics of just scoring and things like that, the types of players that they have kind of suit themselves to what Creighton likes to do defensively, which is to let bad shooters shoot the ball. And be like, yeah, if Aaron Thompson can go 6-for-8 from 3-point range, congratulations, you win today. But, you know, he's shooting 13% on the season. So you roll those dice, right? And if it were being, like I said, if it were being played anywhere besides Hinkle and the jersey said anything besides Butler, I wouldn't think twice about it. But Creighton has struggled there. I don't know, you know, a lot of people talk about how the court's situated the wrong way and the sight lines are weird, which I've been there. It's all true. The sight lines are weird. You can speak to it more than I have. I haven't shot there or played a basketball game there. It's a weird venue, right? But this Creighton team also relies on shooting dramatically less than any Creighton team we've seen in the last 10 years.
Yeah, very true. And the last point I'll make, Robbie, is just they'll need – typically on the road, you just need one senior guy to step up, right? Whether it's a Hawkins or it's an Alex O'Connell who steps up, and even if it's one timely shot, and even if it's on paper, you think, oh yeah, Creighton, easy, you know, 7-to-10-point win, not a big deal. They're still going to need that shot to come around at some point. And so expect a big shot from Alex O'Connell or Ryan Hawkins to maybe get some momentum going or close out that game tomorrow night.
Well, and I want to throw Ryan Kalkbrenner in there as well. I don't think Butler has any kind of size to deal with Kalkbrenner. You've got Golden, who's 6'9", but I mean, Kalkbrenner's got 4 inches on that guy. I mean, that's a lot when you're talking about somebody of that size. Golden's probably their most efficient offensive player. He's going to have a really hard time with Ryan Kalkbrenner's length on the defensive side. And he's going to have a hard time, I think, with him. He's going to be able to just shoot over him if he's able to get his post position deep enough, Kalkbrenner, that is. So I maybe look at Kalkbrenner a little bit to see, you know, he's not a senior, but he's, you know, as a sophomore, a veteran on this team, basically, because of how young everybody else is, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if we see Kalkbrenner with some big moments there, too, when maybe things are getting a little tight for Creighton. But you're right. Those more experienced guys, Alex O'Connell's been playing great in conference play. Ryan Hawkins hasn't been playing as well as of late, but he's used to these types of atmospheres. It wouldn't surprise me if we're talking about one of those guys this time next week, if Creighton is able to come away with a W against Butler.
Yeah. What's final score? What is your prediction?
Ooh, I'm so bad at this with Creighton. It's brutal. I'm going to go – we're going to keep it low scoring because – but that's what Butler does. They can't score the ball, really. I'm going to say I wouldn't be surprised if it's a pretty similar score as we had with Providence and Butler. That game was 69-62. I'll change it up a little bit. I'll say Creighton wins 71-63.
71-63. Okay. I have 66-60.
Okay. So we're in the same neighborhood. We're on the same page there.
Yeah. I think they'll probably, I think Creighton will be favored by a few points going into tomorrow's matchup, but I think it's going to be a close game. I think Butler always plays a little bit better at home. And I just hope Creighton can come out of Hinkle with a W, because it's few and far between.
It really is. Creighton currently a 4.5-point favorite. So both pick them to cover, it sounds like, which, again, if you know me at all, I'm terrible at betting Creighton. So don't take that advice even a little bit. but hopefully we're right and Creighton can come out with a victory here. Anything else that I missed, Taylor, that you wanted to talk about?
No, sir. I'm looking forward to our next segment and, maybe we'll come up with another barn burner of questions on Get to Know You.
Yeah, so we've got Creighton and Ben Butler on Wednesday night, and then we've got Georgetown – or no, that I'm sorry, I'm looking at Butler's schedule here. So we've got Creighton and Butler on Wednesday, and then we've got Creighton and Xavier on Saturday. So we'll probably come to you after Creighton and Xavier so we can give you the full week recap once again. But yeah, I'll try and think of another little icebreaker for us so we can continue the Get to Know You segment on Let It Fly over here.
I love it. We got Pink Out game on Saturday back at home at CHI for a great cause. And that game is always incredible. So hopefully everybody gets out there and is able to see that moment, because it's pretty special when everybody stands up and has somebody on their card that's been affected by cancer. So I think Mac will tell you that's kind of his pride and joy, and something he's more proud of that than any of the wins that he's been able to accumulate at his time at Creighton.
100%. Yeah. Don't forget about the pink out on Saturday against Xavier. Make sure you wear your pink. I actually got some pink Iversons that I'm going to wear on Saturday. Like that, they just re-released those original, I think they're called the original.
Oh yeah.
The original Iversons. So that it's got like the pink toe and then kind of the pink accents around it. So I'm excited about those. We're going to wear those on Saturday, but
yeah, I hope there's a camera angle of those somewhere on
LinkedIn. I'll make sure to get a picture for you so you can check those out. Maybe we'll post it with the next podcast, but we will come to you again sometime next week. It'll depend on game schedule, what days these go out, but we'll get to you at least once a week for sure. For Taylor Stormberg, Ravi Lula, this has been episode 2 of the Let It Fly podcast on Jays 24/7.